is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Everything that LeBron predicts is going to happen on the basketball court, it almost happens exactly how he predicts it, right? But it's only because he's gone through those reps so many times that he's figured out how to refine and eliminate those errors. He knows exactly how to move his body to get the ball in the position that he wants. And so you need those reps, you need those errors to learn so that your brain can refine. Like, your brain is a learning machine. It's going to do it automatically, but you have to be willing to put yourself in the position to experience that failure so that you can have the learning and update for next time.
James Clear is an author and speaker focused on habits, decision-making, and continuous improvement. His work has appeared in the New York Times, Time, and Entrepreneur, and on CBS This Morning. His website receives millions of visitors each month, and hundreds of thousands subscribe to his popular email newsletter. James is a regular speaker at Fortune 500 companies, and his work is used by teams in the NFL, NBA, and Major League Baseball. Through his online course, The Habits Academy, Clear has taught more than 10,000 leaders, managers, coaches, and teachers. The Habits Academy is the premier training platform for individuals and organizations that are interested in building better habits in life and work. If you enjoyed this episode of the Hoopheads podcast with James Clear, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast app you use to listen to the show. You will definitely want to take some notes as you listen to my conversation with James Clear, author of the New York Times best-selling book, Atomic Habits. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. I'm your host, Mike Klinzing, and today we are here with James Clear, New York Times best-selling author of the book, Atomic Habits. James, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, good to talk to you.
Yeah, we are excited to have you on the show today and get a chance to dig into some of the things from your book that I really think can help basketball players and coaches improve themselves and really get to where they'd like to go. So let's start out, though, by talking about how you came to be an expert on habits and just talk a little bit about the experience that you had when you were a sophomore in high school and how that led you to become interested in the topic of habits.
Well, I had been an athlete all my childhood and ended up playing baseball for quite a while. But when I was a sophomore in high school, I was suffered this serious injury where I was hit in the face with a baseball bat. And it was an accident, but the injury was very significant. Shattered both eye sockets, broke my nose, broke the bone behind my nose. I ended up, you know, not being able to swallow or breathe on my own. I had to be air carried to the hospital and suffered multiple seizures, had to undergo surgery. Later that night, I ended up being placed into a medically induced coma and then was released from that the next day once I had been stabilized. And it really took me, you know, 8 or 9 months to recover from that injury. You know, my first physical therapy session, I was practicing basic motor patterns like walking in a straight line. I had to go back in a week later for surgery on my nose. I had double vision for weeks. I couldn't drive a car for 8 of the next 9 months. So it was a significant injury and a long road to recovery. And it was a time in my life when I was forced to start small. And, you know, I didn't really have a choice to, I couldn't like flip a switch and just magically be back to where I was before or be back on the baseball field or things like that. So I had to focus on small things that I could actually manage. And it started with little habits that, you know, are not impressive in their own right in any way. It was things like making my bed each night or making sure I would prep for an hour or study before class. Or I started going to the gym consistently and working out like 3 days a week. And no single habit was like transforming my life, but they gave me a sense of control again. You know, I kind of felt like that had been taken away from me, that this injury just sort of happened to me and I didn't get a say, didn't get to control that in any way. And gradually, as I started to add kind of one habit after another and regain some of that sense of control, I tried to make it back onto the baseball field. And the next year I ended up being cut. So I was the only junior to be cut from the varsity team. And my senior season, I made the team, but barely got to play. And somehow I was able to weasel my way onto a college team a few years later. And I came off the bench my first year and was a starter my sophomore year. Ended up being the team captain my junior year. And then by the time I graduated, I made the ESPN Academic All-America team. And it was really like a 5 or 6 year process from the point of getting injured to having this kind of, I guess, you know, my career wasn't legendary in any way. Like I never ended up playing professionally, but I do feel like I fulfilled my potential. And that story, that period of my life was the first time when the importance of daily habits and the power of embracing this philosophy of, can I just get 1% better today? Can I just make some small accumulative advantage or make some small continuous improvement each day? And if I can embrace that mindset, then you can end up recovering and perhaps even surprising yourself by what you're capable of in the long run. And so I didn't have a language for it at the time. You know, I was just kind of showing up and doing my thing at practice. I was hanging out with my teammates. I was just trying to get a little bit better, but I never would have said like, oh, I'm just trying to build good habits, or I'm just trying to make, you know, get 1% better today. But that was the time in my life when I experienced that. And it was only a few years later, once I started writing about habits and performance improvement and started working on the book and thinking about those topics in depth from like a scientific and a research-based standpoint, that I started to connect the dots and see how formative that period of my life was for the topics that I write about now.
Do you remember at that time, was your motivation more just to get back to where you were in terms of your normal life, or was it more in terms of, I really love baseball and I want to get back to being a baseball player? What was your initial motivation for those habits that you started to develop at that time?
Well, you know, in the very immediate aftermath, the first day or first week or, you know, first month after you get injured like that, I mean, you just want to be home with your family and get out of the hospital and try to, you know, have some kind of semblance of a normal life again. But I would say fairly quickly after that, I don't know why, but I just had some desire to play again. And I felt like I could be a good player. I don't know why I felt that way. You know, like I don't know why I had that desire, that somewhere inside of me thinking like I could make something of this. But I definitely had that urge or that, that like flame inside to try to see like what is, and honestly, this is still a very deep part of my personality now. I want to know where my ceiling is. I don't know. You know, like that's the thing about potential is like nobody really knows how much you have. It's almost impossible to ever say like you've maxed out your potential. And so I was curious, like, what is that ceiling? You know, like, okay, everybody has challenges that they come across in life, right? Everybody has things that they either stumble into or forced upon them that they didn't ask for. And I didn't ask for this injury, but so what, you know, like maybe I could make something of it. Maybe I could see what I was capable of. Maybe I could find out how high my ceiling was even in the face of some kind of challenge. And like that kind of lights me up, you know, like I get excited about that. Like I said, I don't think there's anything really heroic about my story, but that's just kind of part of my personality is I kind of want to see like, where is that ceiling? What am I capable of? And that was a time in my life when I was challenged more than usual, but I still had that desire to figure that out.
For sure. And I think especially in young kids, and when I say young kids, I'm talking about middle school, high school, college age people, that a lot of times those are the people that are searching for that potential when it comes to athletics. And so I look at your story and I say, wow, here's a guy who had a goal or had, you know, had a desire to do something and see where he could get to. And I think a lot of people would like to be able to maximize that potential. And when you talk about what areas of their life people are trying to maximize the potential when they're in middle school or high school, you know, a lot of times that's in athletics, or maybe it's in music, or it could possibly be in art. And when we think of adults, it's more maximizing your occupation, your career, just your own self-improvement. So you mentioned about trying to get 1% better every day. And I know you shared a story in the book about the British cycling team and their coach, Dave Brailsford, and how he came in and basically turned around a team that had had very little success over the history of English cycling. So can you talk a little bit about what he did in order to be able to get those 1% improvements that you talked about?
Well, when Brailsford came in, the British cycling team had never won a Tour de France. And I think they had won like a single gold medal, you know, 100 years prior or something back in like 1908. And he believed in this philosophy they call the aggregation of marginal gains. And so he was basically looking for what he called these marginal gains, these 1% improvements, these tiny areas where they could make a small advancement or a little improvement. And his philosophy, one of the things that kind of made it different, was he was looking for them in kind of every area related to cycling. So they did a bunch of things that you would expect a cycling team to do. Like they figured out slightly lighter tires to put on the bike, or a more ergonomic seat, or they had each rider wear these biofeedback sensors so they could figure out how each individual responded to the training protocol and then adjust the program to the individual rider. But, you know, there were a lot of professional cycling teams that are doing things like that. So they also did things that nobody else was thinking about. Like they hired a surgeon to come in and teach the riders how to wash their hands to reduce the risk of catching a cold. They split tested different types of massage gels to see which one led to the fastest form of muscle recovery. They painted the inside of the team truck that carried the bikes. They painted the inside of that truck white so that they could spot these little bits of dust and dirt and grime that might get into the gears and degrade the performance of the bikes. And they also had each rider like test what type of pillow would lead to the best night's sleep for them. And then they brought those pillows on the road with them to hotels when they were at big races and events. And so Brailsford's kind of strategy, his overarching thinking here, was like, all right, if we can do this in all these different areas related to cycling, if we can make all these little 1% improvements, then I think we can win a Tour de France within 5 years. That was the challenge that he kind of threw out to the group. He ended up being wrong. They won the Tour de France in 3 years. And then they repeated again in the fourth year with a different rider. And then they had 1 year off. And then I think they've won the last three in a row now. So they've won like five of the last six. And at the Olympics in London in 2012, which was kind of the first time, first big event that they had with like the whole British team, men's team, women's team, dozens of events, dozens of riders. And they had been following this strategy for like 5 years or so at that point. They win 60% of the gold medals available. Same thing in Rio 2016. Again, they win 60% of the gold medals available. And that idea that like 1% improvements are not just nice to have, they're not just like a little cherry on top of your performance, but actually can be the master key to unlocking like remarkable success or elite levels of performance. I think that's a little counterintuitive, somewhat surprising. You know, like people don't necessarily think that. They think, oh, you know, like what is that little bit going to do? But if you can embrace that philosophy of continuous improvement, if you can search for those little margins and advantages in like all the areas related to your craft, then I think you can end up like very surprised by where that philosophy and that approach gets you in just 3, 4, or 5 years.
Do you think he was a little bit ahead of his time? I think of like, as an example, NBA players and what it looked like 20 years ago, 30 years ago, when let's say Larry Bird or Magic Johnson was playing in the, you know, in the 80s, and those guys didn't have all the same advantages that say LeBron has in terms of understanding how to train your body and looking for all these little edges with sleep and rest and recovery and that kind of thing, travel. There's so many more people employed by professional sports teams, again, whether that's and the NBA, Major League Baseball, the NFL, that are watching for all those little potential 1% things. Do you think he was a little bit ahead of the curve with going with that philosophy? Because it seems like now that more and more people are gaining an understanding of how important those little 1% things can be to your ultimate performance.
Yeah, I think for sure. You know, this is a very interesting question because, like, on the one hand, you, I think there are kind of two strategies that you can employ. So the first is like, okay, you always have to stay ahead of the curve. You have to stay kind of like on the perimeter, on the forefront of the most interesting or useful or advanced tactics. And so one thing that that requires is it requires you to deeply understand everything that you could do right now, the stuff that is the standard, right? You need to already know all of that stuff. And then once you have a really firm grasp on the fundamentals and what everybody's already doing, then you can start to look and like search on that perimeter for some advantage that maybe other people haven't figured out yet. And that does, you know, that for sure gives you an advantage. It helps you. That's the thing that like the innovators or the people who are on the leading edge, they're often doing that. Interestingly, the other thing that I see, especially in sports, some of the best coaches and players doing is they know where at what everybody's doing. So they have that like fundamental piece mapped again, but then they can like, when they see the trend, like moving one way, they start to reverse direction or they assume like a counter position that gives them more power than they would have otherwise had. So for example, when the Patriots were making their run to the Super Bowl this year. I think it was in the championship game before the Super Bowl. They threw out a formation and Tony Romo's broadcasting, and it was either a crucial first down or a touchdown. And as they're showing the replay, Romo was like, nobody has seen that formation in 10 years. He's like, that is such an old formation. But that actually is a great example of Belichick's genius, is that he knows that the league is moving pass heavy. So then they start doing more runs, or he knows that the league is moving to certain types of formations and these defenses are seeing it week in and week out. So he pulls out something that's 10 years old. And that thing that's 10 years old, like maybe 4 years ago, it wouldn't have really been an advantage because it was like familiar enough that that it wouldn't have given you the advantage you wanted. But now it's so old that the defenses have been optimized for something else. And so I think about that with basketball right now. You know, like there's been this huge move in the last, 10 years or so in the NBA to like pace and space and shooting a lot of threes and just kind of like restructuring what teams look like, the type of players and shooters that they collect and put together. And I wonder if at some point there'll be a shift in some other direction. I don't know. I'm not sure that like big men will maybe be as valuable as they were before. Maybe you'll start seeing people like more hybrids, like, Embiid is a total freak, right? He's like 7 feet tall, could play any big position you want him to. But the other day he shot 13 threes in a game. So maybe you'll start seeing like, things like that. I know like the pick and roll is on the rise and like more teams are running that than before, whereas like the 90s were more like isolation basketball. So who knows? Maybe there'll be some shift back to isolation. Maybe not. I don't know what the next thing will be. But my point is that assuming a counter position that runs against the trend of what the rest of the people are doing, that great coaches and players are often really good at figuring that out too. They're not only looking for like a margin of improvement that allows them to run the pick and roll or do pace and space 1% better than everybody else. They are looking for that. But they're also looking for a different strategy that maybe, all of a sudden teams are not built to handle this, whereas they were built to handle it maybe 15 years ago.
Know the trend and yet be able to exploit the trend.
Exactly. That's a good way to put it.
So one of the themes that runs through the entire book is this idea that you start with small habits and those small habits continue to have a compounding effect over the course of time. And so I know that you also mentioned in there the Sorites paradox about the sort of the argument of the growing heap, how one day, one time doesn't necessarily make a huge difference. It's not something that's always visible, both whether it's a good habit or a bad habit. And I think about this in terms of athletes and when they make decisions about whether they work out on a particular day or how hard they train or what their nutrition's like. And it's easy just to say, today it doesn't matter. I can have whatever I want for lunch. Or, if I skip this weight workout, it's not really going to make a big difference. And the reality is it's probably not going to make a difference in that one day in how you feel or, in how you look or how you perform. But it's that over long stretches of time, those habits add up. So can you talk about how important that compounding effect is to athletes when it comes to their habits?
Yeah, well, I mean, this becomes increasingly important at the more elite levels, right? Like the Olympians will work for 4 years just to shave 0.02 of a second off their time. And the reason that that is so necessary and that it becomes increasingly important to not overlook a single meal or a single practice session or a single piece of the strategy is that at the highest levels, everybody's talented. Everybody's working hard. Everybody's eating healthy. And so those mistakes end up being the thing that, if you can make sure that you have that mastered, maybe that's enough to get you the 1/100 of a second that you need. But so it becomes even more important the higher that you go. But as a general principle, I think that it's true at all levels that habits compound to a surprising degree. And it's true both in the positive and negative direction. You know, like habits are a double-edged sword. They can either build you up or they can cut you down. And I think this is one of the reasons why it's crucial to understand what a habit is and how it works and how you can design it to your liking so that you can be the architect of your habits and not the victim of them. And so I like to think about this kind of compounding piece. You can think about it in a couple different ways, but I like to refer to habits as the compound interest of self-improvement. And what I mean by that is the same way that money multiplies through compound interest, the effects of your habits multiply as you repeat them across time. And, you know, like if you have the traditional like compound interest curve where it's kind of that hockey stick curve and, you know, early on the early years, let's say you're saving for retirement and you put $100 away 1 month and you're like, well, you know, what's that do? I can't retire in $100, right? Like that's not going to make that big of a difference. It's very easy to overlook on any given day because the individual contribution doesn't feel like much. And it's only when you get two or three or four decades in that you start to hit that hockey stick portion of the curve and it really takes off. And your habits are not exactly like that, but man, it really feels like that a lot of the time. You know, like you said, it's very easy to overlook any individual decision. Like, what is the difference between eating a salad and chicken for lunch today or eating a burger and fries? Like, not a whole lot, you know, like on any given day, your body looks basically the same in the mirror at the end of the night. The scale doesn't really change. But if you repeat those habits, a slight 1% improvement or 1% decline for 2 or 5 or 10 years, then all of a sudden you turn around and you start to see how significant those daily choices are. And this is one of the challenges of any individual habit or choice is that it feels insignificant in the moment, but actually it's like really meaningful. And so I think part of just talking about that, just talking about the importance of those daily decisions, of how those 1% improvements do compound, just knowing that helps a little bit. But I'll also say, like, this is the value of community, of accountability, of coaching, of having another set of eyes watching you, or of having that social reinforcement of teammates or community members expecting something of you. Because, you know, it's easy for any individual person to overlook that on a daily basis. And there are going to be days when you don't feel like showing up at the gym or doing a workout. And it's easy to let that 1% opportunity slide. But by having somebody else or a group that's expecting it of you, it makes it easier to show up and show up on your bad days, which of course is the only way that you can ultimately end up having good days.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that I was thinking about as I read through the book and just was kind of considering, again, how does it apply to a basketball situation. Let's say I'm a high school basketball coach and I want to get my guys to work out on their own in the summertime. I may not be able to work with them because of the various state rules or whatever the case might be. But maybe I pair up two players and say, okay, here's your off-season program that I want you to be doing. And now you two guys are partners, go and work together. And so by having somebody that you pair up, I think you're going to get probably, based on what you've discovered, that you probably will get better results than if you just hand each kid the workout and say, hey, go do it. If you hand two kids the workout and say, you guys do it together, now you've put that social pressure, you've created a social environment where somebody else is watching you, depending on you and working with you to help you to, you know, complete those processes that the coach is looking for. Does that make sense?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, there's certainly, obviously it's going to depend on the kids that are put together, but you get the right kids together, then yeah, man, I mean, that's really going to help because you're going to get this, you know, social pressure in the best way possible, right? You'll get a little bit of competitive energy going. Like, they're probably going to try harder. They don't want to embarrass themselves. They're not going to skip the workout because they know the other person's expecting them to be there. Yeah, there are all kinds of benefits there. And, you know, this is a very natural human instinct to basically, ultimately, underneath it all, what you want is you want to belong. And, you know, this is true, like, on a daily basis for adults, you move into a new neighborhood and you walk outside on Tuesday night and you see that your neighbors have their recycling bins out. And so then you think, oh, we need to sign up for recycling. Like, that's what people like us do in this neighborhood. And then you stick with that habit for 20 years, mostly because it's socially reinforced. And so the same thing is happening all the time in teams and organizations where certain habits are expected and certain behaviors are socially reinforced. And, you know, people talk a lot about culture of businesses or teams. And I think a lot of the time people assume that culture is something like, you know, the slogan on the wall or the, you know, mission statement that you came up with at the company retreat or the set of goals and ambitions that your team has at the beginning of the season. But like, the true culture of any group is the shared habits of that group. If it's not a habit, it's not really part of your culture. And so one of the strongest ways to ingrain those habits is to start to put people around each other that, you know, you have two people who already have that habit and then you throw a third in the mix. Well, if the third person wants to belong to that group, they start falling in line. They start doing the things that the rest of the group does because that's what's expected. And you know, you see this, like, especially, you know, if you have someone who joins like a CrossFit gym, well, pretty soon they sign up for paleo meal plans and they buy Noble shoes and they've got right. like, you know, a 2-pood weightlifting belt and like all kinds of, they're doing all this stuff that they never planned to do in the beginning, but they start soaking up the habits and behaviors of the other people who are there.
Yeah. We talked to a high school coach, probably a couple months ago about the culture of his team. And he said that one of the things that's made them so good is at some point 5, 6, 7 years ago, they had a player that ended up being a Division I college basketball player. And that guy would come in every morning and work on his game in the gym before school. And at first it was just him. And he kind of set this precedent, set this tone that this is what I'm going to do. And obviously he had a lot of success both as a high school player and then getting an opportunity to play in college. And then as a result, there was one kid that started following him coming up in the morning and then two. And then before you know it, everybody was looking going, man, these guys are some of the best players on the team and here's what they're doing. And now it's just become something that even though that guy's long gone from the program, he established that social norm. And now the coach really doesn't have to do anything. It's really player driven that this habit, this process that's helped them to be successful is in place and it kind of just feeds on itself.
Yeah, that's fascinating. You know, like I love hearing stories like that. And you can totally see how that could work. It almost is more important that it's player driven than coach driven because the players want to do it because they don't want to be left behind by the other players. They don't want to do it because the coach is telling them to do it. You know, it's like the difference between choosing to be in a book club and having your high school teacher assign a book to you.
Like, right.
You know, like when I have stuff assigned to me, I didn't want to read any of it. Now I read all the time. But it's the difference between like self-motivation and having it forced upon you. But yeah, that's a good example.
Yeah, choice. I mean, I think when you make the choice, and I'm sure it goes to anything, like someone could pick up this book and be motivated and read it and suddenly change lots and lots of things about their life. And somebody else who maybe was, you know, a high school teacher assigns, hey, we want you to read Atomic Habits, and a kid has no interest in changing or getting better or doing anything. It's, you know, it's kind of like you said that the cue is presented, but there is, you know, the craving doesn't exist in one person and in the other one, it does. Mm. So let me ask you a little bit. One of the other things that that I pulled out that I loved more than anything, I think, in the book is the fact that you said that I believe it was an Olympic coach that came to you one time and said that the biggest threat to success is boredom and not failure. And I think as an athlete, that's something that really jumped off the page at me that I said, wow, it's totally profound because I think about the amount of time when I was a kid that I spent just by myself working on different parts of my game. And again, my friends might've been at the pool or hanging out or going to a party, whatever. And I was in there working on my game. And most of the time I was working on the same things. I wish I had grown up in the era today where there was so much more knowledge about how to train. My workouts probably would have been a lot less boring, but regardless, you know, you had to stick with the fundamentals over and over again. And I think that that's something that the best of the best are able to continue to focus on, those small things that enable them to be successful over the long term. Can you talk a little bit about that part of getting to success?
Yeah. So I, once I finished my baseball career, I was looking for another competitive outlet. So I started doing, Olympic weightlifting and a couple different competitions there and just training with the team. And it was fun. It was great to be exposed to that. And we had this great Olympic coach who came to train with us one day. And I wasn't that great, but we had some very good lifters on the team, one of whom ended up competing at the Olympics. And I was talking to him after the session, just asking him, you know, like, what's the difference between the people who are great and, you know, everybody else that's in here getting their reps in? And, you know, there are some things that he said that you would expect, like nutrition and genetics and things like that. But he was like, honestly, at the end of the day, it comes down to who can do the same lifts over and over again every day and not get bored with it. And I just remember thinking about that and being like, it reminded me a little bit of what my dad used to tell me when I was in grade school and high school, where it was kind of, I don't know why, but it was kind of like already decided in my mind that I was going to play in college, even like long before any, you know, that was the, I was even looking at colleges or whatever. And one of the things that he said was that just watch, like every year guys will just quit. Guys will it's not that they have to quit. It's just guys will get bored or they'll give up. And he was right. Like every year that you keep playing, guys just fade away.
There's an attrition. There's an attrition level there for sure.
Yeah. You know, and like some, I mean, sometimes it's forced on you, right? Sometimes you get cut from the team, but man, there's a lot of guys that just, they just fade away. Whether it's freshman, sophomore, junior, senior year, then same thing when you get to college, you know, you got guys who come out for the team in the fall and then they just decide to stop playing sophomore year, junior, same thing. I think by the time we got to my senior season, in college, we had four guys left from a class of 10 that had come in. And, I don't know, there's like something just to be said for perseverance, you know, like, I mean, this is, we're talking about something that's like almost even separate from your playing ability at this point. It's like just the willingness to continue to work. And that counts for a lot. I think that actually counts for a lot in life too. You can win a surprising amount of the time just by being the last one to give up. And so I sort of like first started to learn that lesson in sports and have maybe internalized it in some other areas of my life as well.
Registration is now open at www.headstartbasketball.com for this summer's Head Start Basketball Camps. We'll be hosting camps this summer in Strongsville, Westlake, Avon Lake, Oberlin, Brunswick, Highland Heights, Mentor, and Hudson. At Head Start Basketball, we care deeply about making a positive impact on the lives of young basketball players, both on and off the court. It's through building strong relationships with our players, parents, and coaching staff that we are able to use the game of basketball to enrich the lives of those we interact with, both inside and outside of our organization. We believe that our attention to detail, our growth mindset, and our commitment to lifelong learning allows us to help our players achieve their fullest potential. We are passionately committed to providing players, parents, and coaches with everything they need to reach their goals. These core values run through everything we do. Check out our website, www.headstartbasketball.com, and discover why you should attend a Head Start Basketball Camp this summer. Hope to see you there.
There still remains the challenge, which is the original question that you brought up, of dealing with boredom, you know, dealing with the fact that you got to keep putting your reps in every day. And I've thought about this a lot over the years. I feel like one strategy that can be helpful is trying to find a new aspect of the same thing to get interested in. So, for example, I just came across this. My dad's into weightlifting too, so he's always like looking at videos and telling me about little things or whatever. And he came across this video of this guy front squatting, and he talks about this different cue where basically when you're doing a front squat, you push your elbows out. So you got to keep your elbows up under the bar as well, but you push them out. And when you do that, it naturally straightens the upper back, so you're able to maintain a better position. Well, he just told me about this a couple weeks ago. I haven't had a chance to try it yet, but I think that's a good example of next time I do a front squat, next time you're in there just like putting your reps in like you normally do, now I have something to not be bored about. I have something to focus on, a little detail of the movement that I hadn't thought about before. Now I can do the reps and I can think about keeping my elbows out and keeping my upper back straight. And I think you need to search for little things like that all the time, because the truth is, this is one of the downsides of building good habits. You know, you're in the gym, you're doing the same routine again and again. You're starting to develop fluency and skill and ability with the stuff that you had to think carefully about at first. Now those moves are starting to become more seamless. But the more that you can do something on autopilot, the more that you can do something effortlessly and habitually, the more likely you are to overlook little mistakes. When you can do it good enough on autopilot, you stop thinking about how to do it better. And that's one of the threats of boredom, is not only does it lose its novelty for you, you also lose your edge where you're kind of searching for a way to do it better. And so I think a lot of the process of mastery is continuing to repeat the fundamentals that everybody else gets bored with doing, but finding a new detail in them to stay fascinated with, so that you can remain focused and have something interesting to work on each day.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think that's a great tip for people out there who are, you know, at the stage where, hey, I'm pretty good at this. Now, how do I go and continue to improve? I think in today's society, with access to information through the internet, it's a lot easier to search out and find those things than it might have been 20 years ago. So when you're out there and you're working on, again, I'm going to equate it to basketball, you're out there working on your shot or you're working on a particular move, you can now find literally thousands of videos or different drills or things that you can work on that can maybe work on the same skill and yet provide a little bit of spice to be able to get you to focus. It also talks to something that you mentioned in the book which is the idea of deliberate practice and kind of being at the edge of your comfort zone. And that's really where the most valuable practice occurs, because when it's too easy, you know, you get bored and you're not really improving. And if it's too hard, then you have a tendency to give up. So you got to be right there at the edge of your comfort zone. And I think what you're describing when you talked about the front squat and the position of your elbows, you're talking about somebody who, when you start doing that in a new way, you're now dialed in to those details. And that focus and that concentration is really what allows you to improve and get better. So can you talk a little bit about how important it is to be right there at the edge of your comfort zone with deliberate practice in order to continue to improve?
Well, I refer to this as the Goldilocks rule, which is basically saying that humans experience peak levels of motivation and engagement when they're working on a task of just manageable difficulty. Not too hard, not too easy, just right. So that's that Goldilocks zone. And like you said, you know, like imagine you're playing tennis, right? You play against a professional tennis player like Roger Federer, Serena Williams, or somebody.
That's not going to go well.
Yeah. You know, it's like, it's cool for the first point, but then like you lose every point, right? So it gets boring pretty quickly. Play against a four-year-old, like it might be cute for a minute, but if you're trying to have a serious match, same thing, super boring. You win every point. But if you play against someone who's like your peer, more or less your equal, you win a few points, they win a few points, you have a chance to win, but only if you really try. That's when you kind of get in that state of flow. You're like just on the edge of your ability. And those are some of the most engaging and motivating moments. And so when it comes to both training and competing, that's what you're really looking for. You know, I think this is one reason why you often hear that, you know, if you have two siblings, the younger sibling ends up being the better one in sports because they're always playing slightly up, you know, like the 8-year-old is always playing against the 10-year-old or whatever. And it's not that they can never win or never score, but man, they got to really try. They're like always on the edge of their ability. And that ends up like fashioning their skills really well. And so a lot of the challenge of, you know, finding ways to get better is figuring out like, where is the perimeter of my ability right now? And can I step just a little bit beyond that? There, scientists have tried to quantify this, which I think is somewhat of a fruitless endeavor for a lot of areas, but like generally what they've found is about 4 to 5% beyond your current ability is kind of what you're looking for. That's that sort of magical window where maybe you're capable of it, but you don't always get it right. But I think it's important to note, even if you just leave the numbers aside, you're basically just trying to stretch yourself a little bit. You do need to succeed a fair amount of time, actually. Again, depending on the research study you look at, the ideal ratio is about half the time you actually win. You do it right. And that's a good amount of success. You know, like one out of every two times you're getting it. But you still have that challenge, that failure one out every two times where it's like, oh, I'm not quite getting it, but it's, you know, it's coming along. And so you have just enough challenge to stay engaged, just enough success to stay motivated. And that balance can be tricky to find, and it's always a moving target. But that's a great way to maintain that motivation for the long run and continue to hone your skill set as you move on.
Yeah, I think as a coach, that's one of the things that I look at when I'm working with a particular player, and you try to get them to push maybe and go a little bit faster or try to take a bigger step or jump a little bit higher, whatever the case might be. And you want to get them to get out of their comfort zone, and you want to make sure that they're doing something where they are occasionally going to make mistakes. I think a lot of times, especially I think the younger you go and the less talented is the wrong way to say it, but the less accomplished player tends to want to make less mistakes versus the player who's more accomplished, at least in a practice setting, you know, is okay with, hey, I'm trying this new thing and I really want to get it. I'm determined to get it. Whereas if you're working with a fourth grader, let's say on a basketball court, they don't necessarily want to make mistakes. They want to be able to get it right. And sometimes you kind of have to push them that it's okay. I know I talk about all the time with when I'm working with youth age players of it's okay to make a mistake. If you're not making any mistakes, then you're probably really not getting better. And I think that's something that sometimes is a challenge to get across. I'm sure it goes across all age levels, but that's one of the things that I find to be a challenge.
Well, you're not to get too scientific with it, but basically it's something that's called prediction error in the brain. So like you want to do a particular move. Let's say you're working on like a crossover between your legs or something. And you predict that this is going to play out in a certain way. You can like see the move in your mind before you do it. And then you try it, but it doesn't work. The ball bounces off your knee or hits on your foot, or you don't quite make the move in the correct way. So there's an error between what you predicted was going to happen and what actually happened. And that's what we call that in everyday life is learning, right? Like it's right. Actually that prediction error that tells you, oh, I need to change something. And so in a lot of ways, if you're not making mistakes, you're not learning. You're not updating your predictions so that you can do it slightly better next time. And, you know, ultimately, that's what skill and fluency looks like, right? Like everything that LeBron predicts is going to happen on a basketball court, it almost happens exactly how he predicts it, right?
Right.
But it's only because he's gone through those reps so many times that he's figured out how to refine and eliminate those errors. He knows exactly how to move his body to get the ball in the position that he wants. And so you need those reps, you need those errors to learn so that your brain can refine. Like your brain is a learning machine. It's going to do it automatically, but you have to be willing to put yourself in the position to experience that failure so that you can have the learning and update for next time.
For sure. Now let's jump to the idea of goals versus systems that you talk about in the book, because a lot of people, when they want to accomplish something, they say, well, I'm going to set a goal and my goal is to lose weight. My goal is to shoot 80% from the free throw line. My goal is to lower my 40-yard dash time. But they don't necessarily think about the whys and the hows that they're going to do that. And that's where this system of atomic habits comes in. So can you talk a little bit about the difference between goals and systems and why you feel a system-based approach is better than a goal-based approach?
Well, so before I rag on goals, I'll just say that I think goals are they're not useless, right? I think they serve a purpose. So one thing that goals do is they tell you what to focus on and they make it easier to filter out other distractions, right? Like if you come across an opportunity and it doesn't help you get to your goal, it becomes much easier to say no to that than you otherwise would if you didn't have a goal. I mean, maybe you just take whatever the world throws at you. But once you have some level of clarity around what you're working on, I think it's almost always more useful to put the goal on the shelf and focus on the system instead. And so the way that I would describe it is the goal is the outcome that you want. The system is the process you're going to follow to get there, right? And so if you take, for example, a basketball coach, your goal might be to win the championship, but your system is the way that you recruit players and assistant coaches, the process that you have for reviewing film, the drills that you do at practice each day. And the same thing is true in many other areas of life. If you're a runner, your goal might be to finish the marathon, but your system is the training program that you follow each week. If you're a musician, your goal might be to play a particular piece, but your system is the method that you use to practice different scales and measures and stuff like that. And my point here is that if you were to forget about the goal once you had already had that clarity, if you were to set it on the shelf and leave it alone and not look at it and focused only on your system, would you still get results? And I think you would, you know, like especially in sports, the goal at the end of any game is to have the best score on the scoreboard. But if you spent all game just looking at the scoreboard, thinking about the goal, it would be ridiculous. You would never score a point, right? Whereas conversely, if you just didn't bother looking at the scoreboard, well, maybe there's a little bit of downside for the coach from a strategy standpoint or something. But honestly, you'd probably win a lot of games if you were so completely maniacally, singularly focused on the system. John Wooden used to say that about his training and practice. Like they would basically never talk about the team that they were playing, which sounds kind of crazy to a lot of coaches who spend a lot of time on scouting reports and thinking about, you know, reviewing film and things like that. But basically, he was just so focused on them getting their reps in and making sure that they could run their system to perfection that he figured whoever we end up playing, like, it's not going to matter that much. And so I think that there are a couple other reasons that we kind of over focus on goals or we overvalue goals. Like one thing that's a little bit surprising is that the winners and losers in any particular domain, they often have the same goals, right? So like presumably every team that's going to be in the March Madness bracket has the goal of winning the championship. Right. Like it's not the goal that is actually the difference between them. It's the system that they follow, the process that they have, the way that their coaches recruited players in, the way that they've trained all year, the practice that they did. Same thing is true, like on the job market. If you have 100 candidates apply for a job, Well, every candidate has the goal of getting the job. It's not the goal that separates them. And similarly, like goals also, achieving a goal only changes your life for the moment. You know, like if for Tom Brady, the only thing that mattered was winning the Super Bowl, then after he won that first one 17 years ago or whatever that was, he could have retired. That could have been it, right?
Goal's
like,
over.
In a weird way, I think for Brady and Jordan and LeBron and Gretzky and all of these incredible famous athletes, Serena, it is both about the goal, but actually not at all. You know, it's like true long-term thinking is goalless thinking. It's actually much more about like kind of what we mentioned near the beginning of this episode. Like, where's my ceiling at? What am I capable of? How great could I actually be? What could I squeeze out of myself if I was willing to show up again tomorrow and see if I could get just a little bit better? And if you do that, that's how you end up with someone who, you know, wins 5 Super Bowls or wins 23 Grand Slams or goes to the NBA Finals 6 times or whatever it is. And so I think that it's really only a focus on the system that will get you those kind of results. If you make it just about the outcome, then you often will stop once the outcome's been achieved the first time.
I also think that when you focus only on the outcome, and this probably applies at least as much to young athletes as it does to professional athletes, and that is that a lot of times you can't control the outcome of a game or a season. I may play on a team where I'm on a sixth grade basketball team and we go out and we're going to play against our opponent who is way better than us. And 100 times out of 100, that other team is going to beat us. And so even though our goal may be to win that game or to have an undefeated season, we may not be able to reach that goal simply because we're just not as good as the people on our schedule. And so if the only thing we judge our failure and success on is, did we meet our goal? Well, we're going to be very, very unhappy. And I think one of the things that I like about the process versus outcome or goal versus system is that we can find success inside of the process and not just always have to have success be defined by the outcome. And that's one of the things that I try to teach to, again, any player, any team that I'm coaching is, look, we can have a goal and we can all want to win, but when the game's over, if we didn't win, we need to be able to look ourselves in the mirror. I know you mentioned John Wooden before, and one of the quotes that I love that Wooden has is about success. And, you know, he defines success as a peace of mind, which is a direct result of the self-satisfaction and knowing you did your best to become the best you're capable of becoming. And again, if you do that most often, like you said, a lot of times you are going to reach your goal. But in times when you don't win the Super Bowl, you can still look back and say, did I do everything I possibly could? Did I self-maximize myself in order to be able to be my best? And I think when you do that, I think it ultimately provides more satisfaction than just strictly looking at that outcome.
I think that's right. You know, I mean, this is another one of the downsides of a goal-based mindset is that goals have a tendency to push happiness off until the next milestone. It's like, oh, well, once we win, then I'll be happy. Or after I lose those 30 pounds, then I'll be satisfied with how I look. Or, you know, if I get A's, then I'll have done a good job. And when it only becomes about the goal, you're basically always just pushing happiness off until that future moment. Whereas if you're focused on the system and the process, as you said, not only do you have more influence over that, right? It's actually within your control. Whereas if you're playing a tennis match, you don't control the outcome. You influence the outcome. You have control maybe over your shot, but you don't have control over your opponent's shot. So by focusing on the process, you actually are focusing on something that's within your control. And back to the happiness point, you can be happy anytime the system is running, anytime the process is being completed. You know, like you can, to take a very common one for adults, like if you think about weight loss, if you're only happy after you've lost the 30 pounds, well, then you can only be happy during that one moment. You're not allowing right. yourself to enjoy it for the whole time that you're going to the gym. But if instead, if you're focused on the system and building the identity of someone who doesn't miss workouts, well, now each time you show up and put a little X on the calendar or fill out your workout journal and finish another workout, you can feel happy with the fact that the system is running. You can be satisfied and feel fulfilled with the fact that you're showing up again. And I don't know, I feel like that counts for a lot in the long run. Giving yourself the permission to enjoy the process rather than always pushing happiness off to some future moment.
Yeah, I think it's really a it's just a benefit to looking at it from a process-based versus an outcome-based setting, in that you can derive that satisfaction throughout the time that you're working towards something. And in it, every moment you can find enjoyment. Whereas, to your point, if you think about the Tom Brady example, so he wins the Super Bowl, how long does that high, that emotional joy of winning the Super Bowl, how long does that last? 24 hours, 48 hours, a week? And then a week later, the joy and the, you know, the immediacy of that moment has worn off. If that's the only thing that was important to him and he didn't enjoy the process of practicing and training and doing all those things, then it's not going to make for a very, a very enjoyable, a very enjoyable time in his life, because he's only focused on that one thing, and that one thing is so fleeting.
You know what else is funny is we all think that these goals are going to like define us, that they'll bring us this happiness or satisfaction. I mean, I've felt this myself recently, right? Like, I just spent the last 3 years working on this book, pouring everything I had into it and trying to launch this and do the best job possible. And we were able to accomplish what we set out to do, right? Like, we hit the New York Times bestseller list. We've been on it multiple times, been on there every month since the book has come out. I mean, it's been every bit of the success I would have hoped that it could be. But you're right. I don't know how long it was. Maybe it was a few days, maybe it was a week. But at some point, you kind of return back to your baseline. And what's interesting about an experience like that, I mean, you know, it was very meaningful to me. I put a lot of work into it. But what you realize is, if it hadn't happened, I would have been fine too. And it's really the fact that you're like interested in the process of showing up at the gym every day or writing every day. It's really that process that ends up defining you anyway. Like, that's more what I attach my identity to than the fact that, oh, I was on the New York Times list. Although, you know, that was great. Like, I love that. Just like I'm sure Brady loves winning the Super Bowl. But it's almost like it's the daily process that ends up defining you anyway. And so in a weird way, the things that we think are going to matter the most, they end up being like the background, and the thing that we often overlook, the daily process and the habits and the rituals, that ends up taking center stage.
Well, and you said it yourself that you wanted to maximize your potential. And I'm sure that as you were writing the book, you were working towards that goal of, how can I be the best writer that I possibly can be? How can I put out the best book that I possibly can? And then once the book was written, it was out of your hands. At that point, the outcome of whether it ended up being a New York Times bestseller or whether it ended up on a dustbin at Barnes & Noble was no longer up to you. It was up to the audience that was out there and whether or not they were going to find value in the book. But I'm sure your process was, I'm getting better every day as a writer. I'm sharing things. I'm learning things. I'm getting closer to maximizing my own potential. And again, there's no better example of basically what you wrote than the process that you went through.
Yeah, that's interesting. I remember, it reminds me of something I had this weightlifter told me one time, where he had just competed at the American Open and like done well in the national championships. I think he placed on the podium, but didn't win. But, he basically said, like, the climb is the funnest thing. That's the best part of the whole process, is the climb, like the feeling of making the progress, of you're showing up and like, yeah, I mean, it sucks sometimes. It's really hard. You know, it's hard to write a book. It's hard to push yourself physically. It's hard to try to make a college team or whatever the thing is that you're working on right now. But the climb is the great part, because you're growing every day. And so, yeah, I don't know. Like, once you hit the goal, the climb is done. And so now it's actually the less interesting part of the process, or the less enjoyable part of the process.
Right. The climb up to that goal. Now you're looking and you reach the goal, and then it's, well, if you're a person that's looking for the next challenge, then you got to go out and figure out what the next, what the next thing is on your list, whether that's winning a Super Bowl or writing a New York Times bestseller or making your high school varsity basketball team, whatever it is. Yep. You're always looking for that next challenge. I'm only about a third of the way through my notes, but I want to make sure that we hit your four steps to building good habits and breaking bad ones. So let's just touch on those for a minute, maybe just share what those four steps are for both building good habits, breaking bad habits, and then we'll wrap up by letting people know how they can reach out to you and get your book and find out more about what you're doing.
Sure. So, you know, the book covers all these strategies and tactics in much more detail, but just from a high level, I like to divide a habit into four stages. And if you understand those four stages, then you kind of have a better chance of adjusting and improving your habits. So quickly, they're cue, craving, response, and reward. So there's a cue, something that catches your attention, like you see a plate of cookies on the counter. That's a visual cue that starts the habit of eating a cookie. Or an ambulance, you hear the siren behind you, and that's an auditory cue to pull to the side of the road. Then there's the craving, which I would describe as the meaning that you assign to the cue. So it's the way you interpret it. So like for, let's say two people walk into a living room and there's a pack of cigarettes on the coffee table. For one person who is a smoker, they might interpret that visual cue as meaningful and think, oh, I feel, you know, I have the urge to smoke a cigarette. For another person who's never smoked, they see them and the cue doesn't mean anything. It's just a pack of cigarettes and they move on and they don't act on it. So whether you take action or not depends a lot on how you interpret the cues in your life. Then there's the response. So you see the cookies on the counter. You interpret them as, oh, this will be sugary, tasty, sweet. I should grab one. You take a bite. That's a response. And then the final stage is the reward. And so it is sugary, sweet, tasty, etc. So it's rewarding or enjoyable. Now, you've got those four stages, cue, craving, response, reward. And then you can come up with what I call the four laws of behavior change. And this is sort of the backbone of the book. And so each of these four laws, it's like a rule or a principle that you can follow for making it easier to build good habits or more difficult to fall into bad ones. So for the cue, the first law of behavior change is to make it obvious. You want to make the cues of your good habits obvious, available, visible, easy to see. The more obvious they are, the more likely they are to catch your attention and you take an action. For the craving, the second law of behavior change is you want to make it attractive. The more attractive or appealing a habit is, the more likely you're going to feel motivated to perform it. I talk about some ways to do that in the book. For the response, the third law of behavior change is to make it easy. The easier, simpler, more convenient a habit is, the more likely you are to perform it. So one way to do this is to make your habits really small, but there are a variety of others I mentioned in the book as well. And then finally, for the reward, the fourth law of behavior change is to make it satisfying. The more satisfying, enjoyable, pleasurable a habit is, the more likely it is to stick. When the ending is satisfying or when you feel successful at the end of a habit, you have a reason to come back to it again the next time around. And so those four laws, make it obvious, make it attractive, make it easy, make it satisfying. That gives you a framework for building a good habit. And then if you want to break a bad habit, you just invert each of those four. So rather than making it obvious, you want to make the cues of your bad habits invisible. Rather than making it attractive, make it unattractive. Rather than making it easy, make it difficult, and then make it unsatisfying. And so those four laws and the inversion of those four give you kind of like a clear high-level framework for shaping a good habit and breaking a bad one. And obviously the book goes into much more detail on how to do each of those four things.
Absolutely. To any basketball player, coach, anybody who's listening out there, I would highly recommend going out and picking up a copy of James's book, Atomic Habits. I've read it now twice, and it's already made an impact in my life with some of the things that both from a good habit and a bad habit standpoint. So I would highly recommend going out there and picking it up. James, we can't thank you enough for having spent an hour with us here on the Hoopheads podcast. If you wouldn't mind, share out exactly how people can get the book, find out more about you, and just learn how they can benefit from Atomic Habits.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much. I'm glad you're enjoying the book. And if you'd like to check it out, you can go to atomichabits.com. That'll go straight to the book. And for all of my other work, you can just go to jamesclear.com. You can also find the book by clicking on books there. If you click on articles, then you'll see some of my other writing, and it's organized by topics. You can poke around a little bit and see what interests you. And everything else is on there as well, social media profiles and whatnot. So all of that is at jamesclear.com.
Fantastic. James, we can't thank you enough for spending an hour with us today. And to everyone out there, we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.